This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you know I love Friday because that means we get to do our week in review, and we have so much to talk about this week. We got to start with politics because, you know, New Hampshire, the primary earlier this week, the top candidates continue on.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
As everyone had counted us out, thank you, pundits, I came back and we delivered.
One day, books will tell not just of one election, but of the era that began with you here in New Hampshire. Thank you.
The primaries have really started. We've heard from two states. We got 55 states and territories ready to go.
Yeah, well, we had the first two rounds made up about 2% of the public. 99% of the African-American vote hadn't voted yet.
Now, some candidates, Michael Bennett, Deval Patrick, Andrew Yang, have bowed out. And it is already getting ugly, from conservative media to the candidates to supporters themselves.
Okay, how's this going to look? 37-year-old gay guy kissing his husband on stage next to Mr. Man Donald Trump.
Drop out Trump!
Skip Nevada! Skip South Carolina! Just go home early!
I would say Bernie looks like he's doing very well.
Why is he surging?
I think people like his message. He's got energy. His people have energy. But they like his message. But a lot of people don't like that particular message.
Michael Bloomberg came in on the... on the billionaire plan, just buy yourself a nomination.
So fresh off of New Hampshire, where are we in the race for president? Share your thoughts. Join the conversation today. I want you to give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So with us here in Studio 3 this week is Jennifer Braceras, a political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Good to see you, Jennifer.
Good to see you.
And also with us is Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. Marie, welcome back.
Good to be here.
All right, it's a lot of tape we just heard at the top. Let's start with our local candidates, because there have been a lot of them. Deval Patrick bowed out after garnering actually less than 0.5% of the vote in New Hampshire. Elizabeth Warren had a fourth place finish in the Granite State. What's your take, Marie?
Oh, well, Deval Patrick came in really late. So I think his ability to recover, was very difficult. I mean, I think it was a very difficult hill to climb. But I think that one of the things one have to say is if you have a dream and you decide to go after it, better to have gone after it than to regret that you've ever tried. And so he tried, and he was realistically enough to step aside, unlike some of the others who remain in the game. Elizabeth Warren must be deeply disappointed because she's invested a significant amount of time in this and has raised a significant amount of money. And this was Massachusetts' neighbor. I mean, this is a tough one. I mean, the New Hampshire should, in my mind, have been a place where, even if she didn't win it, but would have had a much, much stronger showing. So I think it raises a lot of questions about her candidacy.
What do you think, Jennifer?
I think she should seriously think about withdrawing at this point. I mean, she is in danger of losing her own state. And, you know, that may not be the worst thing in the world. Marco Rubio was embarrassed in his own home state when Donald Trump trounced him there in 2016. And he went on to run again for senator and is a very popular senator still from the state of Florida. But I do think that it is embarrassing. It was embarrassing for Rubio at the time. And it would be embarrassing for Warren if she lost Massachusetts, which I think she will.
So I want to kind of pick up on that for a minute. We've got some sound here from a woman named Gilda Cobb Hunter. She's a state representative from South Carolina. She's supporting Tom Steyer. But in talking with BUR, she says that Warren has a shot in South Carolina.
There's a lot of goodwill and support for Senator Warren here. I would advise Senator Warren to not give up on her game based on two states that are not even close to being representative of the voting population in this country.
So it could be really bad for her to lose her own state, and yet she could potentially get traction in some other states. Marie, how should she think about when it's time to pull out? Or if it's time to pull out?
I mean, I don't know that it's time for her to pull out as yet. I think that the next couple of of primaries. I mean, particularly that huge primary Tuesday is going to be really important for to see how she does. I think she still has some money. She still has a ground game. If I know Roger Lau, and Roger Lau is an amazing organizer. If I know him, then he has organized a ground game in many of those states.
And
so
he's
I wouldn't
her campaign
count him out.
Head.
Yeah, and he's her campaign manager. So I wouldn't count her because of him. I would not count her out yet.
Jennifer, you look like you wanted to add something.
I don't think she's going to drop out. I do think she's a fighter, and I think she'll stay in until the money dries up. But I do think it's embarrassing to lose as badly as she did on her home turf. I understand the argument that it's not representative of the country at large, but it is the region that she represents. And therefore, I think it's very embarrassing for her.
Listeners, call in. Share your thoughts with us, too, whether it's on Elizabeth Warren and her candidacy, how you feel about Deval Patrick pulling out, who you think the front runner is now, and what do you think the state of the Democratic Party is at this stage in the presidential race? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to talk, because we have two women analysts this time, I want to talk about this Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren thing a little bit too. Because there's been some sense, and I guess I want to ask if you think it's a false choice or not, that there's really only one room for one front runner woman at this point. I've heard some pundits, you know, talk about, well, now that Klobuchar has her clomentum, as they say, she's going to kind of take over the woman spot from Elizabeth Warren. Are we seeing a campaign that has restricted its imagination about what women can do in a presidential race, Marie?
No, I think we have a country that's restricted its imagination about what a woman can do in a presidential race. Because I think as quietly as it's kept, we as a country have yet to imagine ourselves or accept that a woman could fully be the president of the United States. So I don't think it's these two women. I mean, women, we're a very diverse group of people with various interests and priorities. And those two women actually reflect that. And we wouldn't be saying that about a group of men. I mean, the men who...
We aren't saying about
a group of men who traditionally have been the ones who've been able to come out on top on these races. So I actually think that's a false choice that we're setting out in front of people, and that these two women represent different aspects of American life. And the question is, can they close the deal? And that I'm not certain about.
What do you think, Jennifer?
I disagree that people think there's only one room for one woman in this race, particularly on the Democratic side. I think I think that's a false hypothetical that the media is putting out there. What I do think is true is that there's room for one moderate candidate and one left of center candidate, and that those lanes need to coalesce between those lanes need to each coalesce around one person.
So you're saying sort of the Warren Sanders lane.
I don't think there's room.
Klobuchar,
right.
Lane.
I don't think there's room for both Sanders and Warren, and I don't think there's room for both Klobuchar and, say, Biden.
Okay, let's pick up a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Jennifer on the line from Somerville. Join the panelists, Jennifer.
Hi, I was just on one of the panelists was kept reiterating that it would be embarrassing for Elizabeth Warren to stay in the race and lose, you know, Massachusetts. But I just don't think embarrassment is a good enough criteria. But the guest mentioned it so many times, and I just think embarrassing is, it just seems like a very superficial remark.
What's the right criteria, Jennifer?
That she tries until it's clear. I mean, there have been two votings, and she came in low, but, you know, it's hardly even begun.
All right, so let's pick it up from there, Jennifer, and I'll go to panelist Jennifer, because you were the one that was using the embarrassing term. Mm-hmm. Do you want to answer that?
Well, yeah. I mean, politics is a lot about image. And so, yes, if you can't win your own state, I do think that's problematic. It was problematic for Marco Rubio in 2016. It was problematic when Al Gore didn't win Tennessee in the general election in 2000. Now, is it dispositive? Of course not. But is it Does it make them look bad at some level? Yes, it does.
All right. So let's pick up on this moderate lane and more progressive lane. I want to talk about Pete Buttigieg for a second. At the top of the show, we heard comments Rush Limbaugh made about Pete Buttigieg running as a gay man. President Trump weighed in yesterday on Geraldo's iHeart radio podcast, which is called Roadkill, when asked if Americans would vote for a gay man. Let's listen.
I think so. I think there would be some that wouldn't, and, you know, I wouldn't be among that group, to be honest with you. But I think that, yes, I think that it doesn't seem to be hurting Pete Buttigieg, as you say, as you would call him. It doesn't seem to be hurting him very much. And but there would certainly be a group, you know this better than I do, there'd be a group that probably wouldn't. But, you know, you and I would not be in that group.
So let me ask the two of you, do you think America is ready for a married gay man as president?
I actually do. I think this country has changed dramatically in the past 10 years on that question. We see it with our children. We see it with the younger generations. When I talk to young people, I find that they are just surprised that it ever was an issue, that there ever was a time in this country when gay people couldn't get married. They're actually very surprised by that, even the most conservative young people that I know. So I do think it's generational. And as the president said, of course, there will be some people who, you know, hold that against him and don't vote for him because of that. Just like there will always be some people who, you know, probably held President Obama's race against him or Hillary Clinton's gender against her. I mean, there are always going to be sort of jerks and racists and people that, you know, look at characteristics that aren't relevant to whether you can do the job. But overall, no, it's not going to hold them back.
Marie, did you want to add something to that?
I actually think that this country, and I was in the legislature when we did the first voted for gay marriage the first time, and the rancor that existed in Massachusetts, you think the world was going to fall apart when we first began to really push for on this issue. And we see that the world hasn't. And I think it's been an amazing example to see the ripple effect across the country and to see people embrace it. And the fact is that we've allowed family to pull together on this. Family who probably did not have voice in a way of expressing and embracing their own family members. I think this there's just been a sea change. So I actually believe that that can happen in the United States. I also think today. I also think that particularly with there's an opportunity here with this candidate, given the fact that given the way that he presents himself, given the way that, because it's not simply about him being gay. It's about the fact that he is a qualified young man who has actually fought for his country and has a certain set of skills that would allow him to hopefully negotiate and pull this country together in a way that it's desperately in need of. So I think that there's a significant percentage of people that will focus on the character of the gentleman that is running for office today. I think, as always, just as there were folks who were against Obama, that there's always, as Jennifer says, there's always going to be that segment. But I think we actually have evolved in this country in a way that's positive, where we look at people and you know, we try to really walk away from the characteristics. So Marie can't do this because she's black and she's a woman. Well, no, there's some that Marie has a certain set of skills. Marie has certain connections with, whether it's culturally, socially, that I can identify with, that I can see actually representing me in a way that I think is honorable. And I think at the end of the day right now, anybody but Trump works for me.
All right. I think what hurts Buttigieg more is his age. I think there are a lot of people who believe that he's just a little too young, that maybe he's somebody for 4 years down the road or 8 years down the road, but that he's relatively inexperienced at this point. I think that characteristic hurts him more.
Okay. Our lines are full, and we're going to get to a break faster than we wanted, even imagined. So let me grab a couple of calls here. We've got Tom on the line from Newbury. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Elizabeth Warren losing in New Hampshire. Everyone acts as though it's so surprising, but I live on the North Shore, and a lot of people up in New Hampshire aren't too fond of people from Massachusetts.
Ah, a little rivalry there.
Take my question off the air.
All right, thanks, Tom. Listen, I want to grab two more calls, too, because we've got two callers here who want to talk about Mike Bloomberg. So let's pick those both up. First, we've got Barbara in Lakeville. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. My comment is just that I feel like Mike Bloomberg isn't getting a ton of coverage in these discussions. And yet in the Vanity Fair article that came out over the weekend, some of the examples that are used there, including some of the Twitter correspondence between the two, demonstrates that Mike Bloomberg has a fight in him to help us win this election. And some of that is going to involve a little bit of a street fight element. We got to bring our game if we want to win this next election.
Okay,
and
I'm going to
take my comments after.
Thanks, Barbara. And I am going to pick up Pam here in Concord in a second, but I do want to point out Bloomberg actually wasn't on the ballot in New Hampshire. He got some write-ins, but we've been talking New Hampshire this week, and he actually didn't compete there. He's waited to compete in Super Tuesday and later. Let's pick up Pam in Concord.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm uncommitted right now. I'm an independent. I tend to lean D. I voted for Bill Weld years ago and may vote for him again. But I think all the Democratic candidates are absolutely better than Donald Trump. But I feel like they need to back off Mike Bloomberg and stop trashing him. I mean, America, I believe, is really sick of vitriol, sick of hate mongering, sick of negativity. Be happy for the guy. He shows up. He's loaded. He doesn't need the RNC money. I mean, the DNC money. He's committed to mopping the floor with Donald Trump, and he can expose all Donald Trump's fake business success. I say give the guy a pat on the back and let him run.
So let me turn to the panelists with that. Pam, Bloomberg is ascendant, it seems, at least to some extent, and he's spending his money in later states. He's also controversial because he's spending his money. That's how he's funding his campaign. Marie, you have this really interesting look on your face, so I'm just going to start with you on this.
I'm so conflicted about this. There's a level, when I was in, I worked for the city of Boston, a lot of the, we collaborated a lot with Bloomberg in the work that he was doing, particularly on gun violence. And so there were a lot, and on immigration. And so I am quite familiar with his investment of his own political clout, as well as his own personal money, in order to work on these issues. So he's not new to those issues. What's troubling and what I fight with internally is the fact that he is a man, because he has money, he's able to leapfrog over everyone else in order to be able to run. But he's a gentleman who actually made his money. He earned it. And so we want to celebrate that too in this country. I mean, there's this piece that we're always attacking people who make money. So I'm struggling with
that. You're really torn about it.
I am torn about it. Yeah. But at the end of the day, again, we've got to beat Trump.
Jennifer.
So I think Bloomberg is really attractive to a certain segment of the electorate that wants to beat Donald Trump, but is very, very hesitant about Bernie Sanders and the leftward veer that the Democratic Party has taken. And I've spoken with a lot of Democratic voters who said if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, and even Elizabeth Warren, they may for the very first time in their lives not vote, as much as they dislike Trump. And so they are looking for somebody who, A, can beat Trump, and B, who doesn't want to seize the means of production as they see it. And so that is what's really going on here. That is what is behind the ascendancy of Bloomberg, is that he appeals to moderate people, to people who are socially liberal but more fiscally conservative, people who work in the business world, who are very, very scared of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
All right. So in just a minute, we were going to go to a break. But before we do, I'd like to get a couple more caller voices in because the lines continue to be full. So let's just go out on a couple of more calls. We've got Mary calling from Lancaster. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I'm wondering if I'm the only person wondering if Trump supporters registered as independents can pull a Democratic ballot in the primary and vote for the least likely person to beat Donald Trump.
Both panelists say yes.
So that's a terrific question. Yes. And I will tell you, first of all, that one of the reasons Donald Trump won the nomination in 2016 is because Democrats did that all across the country in states that had open primaries. He was not the choice of the conservatives. He was the choice of, you know, this odd coalition, this odd populist coalition that rose. That is absolutely going to happen again this time. I'm an independent, frankly, and I'm an independent for, I want to say, that exact reason. I mean, I'm a conservative. I was a Republican my whole life. I am voting in the Democratic primary for the very first time in a presidential election this year. I haven't decided how I'm going to use my vote or how I'm going to cast it, but I certainly know that there are a lot of people who are going to use it strategically.
All right. So listen, there's so much more we could talk about this, but it's time for a break and there's a lot else we want to talk about. Marie St. Fleur, Jennifer Braceras, you listening, everyone stick with us. When we come back, we're going to continue the Week in Review talking about Attorney General Maura Healey's lawsuit against vaping manufacturer Juul. So call us about that, 800-423-8255. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Friday Week in Review. I am Tiziana Deering, and still with us here in Studio 3 is Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum, and Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the chief executive officer of a cannabis company. Jennifer, Marie, thanks for staying with us.
Sure, thanks. Sure.
We filed a lawsuit against Juul following an extensive investigation that showed from the outset, from the time Juul came to market in 2015, it launched with the intention of targeting young people.
So that's Attorney General Maura Healey on Radio Boston Wednesday, explaining the Commonwealth's lawsuit against e-cigarette maker Juul. The suit makes a number of other claims as well, such as, you know, Juul recruited social media celebrities and other influencers of young people, placed ads on homework websites and with companies like Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, and actually helped underage consumers bypass the age requirements in Massachusetts to buy Juul products online. Ultimately, Healey is accusing the e-cigarette maker of getting, quote, an entire generation, end quote, addicted to nicotine. So listeners, what do you think? Are you pleased to see this suit? Do you see young people around you using Juul products? And can one company be blamed for a whole public health phenomenon that we're experiencing? You can call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer, you're an attorney. I'm going to start with you. What's your reaction to the lawsuit?
Well, my first reaction was, is there any legal but politically incorrect company that Maura Healey won't sue? I mean, she's gone after ExxonMobil. She's going after the Trump administration. She's going after Juul. You know, it's when is she going to focus on law and order issues in Massachusetts?
So why do you find that problematic?
I find it problematic because in all of these sort of public nuisance type cases against ExxonMobil and the opioid manufacturers and the makers of Juul, the tobacco litigation years ago, you have states going after companies that make legal products in an effort essentially to extort money that the state will then use for public purposes. And I don't think that's a proper use of law enforcement. You know, if we don't like the products, then let's criminalize them or let's regulate them more heavily. And let's stop going after them just to score political points and to fill state coffers.
Well, and to be clear, and I'm going to turn to Marie here, but to be clear, we have done some of that. I mean, the state did restrict the sale of all flavored tobacco products. There was a temporary ban on vaping last year.
Correct.
Marie,
so
I see you feel strongly.
Yeah, I mean, I spent about over 11 years of my life as an assistant attorney general. And I have to say that there is a role for the attorney general in this space, that whether or not there's a compelling state interest in protecting its citizens. And I think that that's been clearly articulated.
Explain that. So what is the compelling state interest?
Yeah. We have a compelling interest in protecting the health of our youngest, of our children. Period. And we know from the evidence that they've identified that that particular company has specifically targeted a set of young children, young people, in order to sell their product. We know that the product has a negative impact on the health of those young folks, and we've had people who've died from it. So should we intervene?
I don't think anybody's died from Juul.
We actually don't know, other than the potential for vitamin E oils in vaping mechanisms.
That's correct. And so, but we know that as a result of the use of that product, that there has been some injury.
Well, not that particular product.
Not that particular product, but we know that there. But wait a minute. So what they're saying is we're going to take some preventative measures in order to protect protect those young people.
Well, take the preventative measures, but don't sue them for money.
But why should they not sue them for money? Because at the end of the day, it is the state that ends up paying for it. The residents of Boston and the other parts of this state, the residents of Massachusetts, will have to end up paying for the health care of these young people who suffer any injury.
Let's throw a call into the middle of this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Richard on the line from Worcester. Richard, you have an opinion on this too, yes?
Yes, I do. And thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Simply put, selling and marketing and advertising and pushing drugs to children and on children in America is generally considered to be wrong and illegal. I don't know why, when a company does it, somehow they're in less trouble than anyone else for behaving the exact same way. I don't even think that they should be brought to civil court. I believe that this would stop if those people had to actually go to criminal court like other people do when they sell drugs to children. But it seems to me that whenever something is doing something at the behest of the economy, or they do it with paperwork and pens, that all of a sudden it's not as significant or serious, and as if it's not a crime.
I want to pick up the first part of that argument there, Richard, and I want to turn it to Jennifer, this idea that this is illegal kind of behavior, and as a result, this is not inappropriate. What's your reaction to that, Jennifer?
Right. I mean, look, I certainly don't think that people under the age of 18 should be buying cigarettes, should be using Juul. You shouldn't advertise them. I agree with all of that. I think the great irony here, though, is in this country, we are constantly raising the age of majority for stuff like that, and yet we want to let 16-year-olds vote. I mean, there's this great sort of disconnect between whether we view 16 and 17-year-olds as mature enough to make decisions or not. And I think there needs to be some consistency on that front when you look at it overall. With respect to Maura Healey's particular lawsuit, you know, the original point I made was just she seems to be bringing a lot of lawsuits that are politically minded and not so much for, you know, relevant to the health and safety and well-being of the people of Massachusetts. She's going after big, unpopular targets, and I think that she has, you know, this is the first step of her campaign for whatever office she's running for next.
So one of the things that seems to be at the heart of what you're both stipulating in the question of this case is the idea that this is an attempt to seek funds from Juul in order to pay for the implications of the amount of Juuling that's being done. Healey cites in her suit and in her conversations around the suit that in the last month, one in three high schoolers has used some sort of e-cigarette, and that teenagers are 16 times more likely than people in their 20s to use an e-cigarette. So she's making some strong cases there. I guess I just want to draw out this disagreement about whether or not it's appropriate to seek financial relief from a company for a product that creates public health
costs.
I'm not
saying it's never inappropriate. I'm saying what you see is this trend where that's the immediate first response in our society now. And so you see these attorneys general from around the country, bipartisan attorneys general, going after these big companies because this is a way, for both political and economic reasons, in a way that, you know, sometimes I think goes a little too far.
But, you know, that, I mean, I think I'm going to agree with the caller, because I think that when we spent years putting people away for cocaine, for crack cocaine, and never touched the companies who were pushing opioids. Never did. Right. I mean,
opioids are legal.
But never did any. But look at what's happened because we didn't. The impact that it's had on communities, on families, and how society has suffered from them. And so it took a whole lot of deaths for us to finally start saying that government should intervene.
You own a cannabis company. You better believe Maura Healey will be coming for you next.
But the reality is, I don't believe that she simply comes after a company simply because the company makes money, because I think that's the argument that's being made here.
When the cannabis industry starts making money, and 10 and 15 years from now, when we see the health effects that it has on children and young adults, which we will see,
then she
mark
should
my
do
words,
about
attorneys
it.
Generals in this country
then,
will
then,
come
then
after
them. Then she should
them.
Do something about it, if that's the case, just like they did something about Marlboro, just like they did something about
You better
about
get out, Marie.
Those,
you better
those,
get out.
Those tobacco companies. But, I mean, the idea that that we should not have consumer protection and that there should not be a way to go after large companies when they're the ones who have the wherewithal in order to push these goods on a community, and they can do that without recourse is unacceptable.
I think we need to determine as a society whether or not certain products should be available in the marketplace and to whom they should be available. And if they are legal, if it's legal to sell them to certain age groups, and if we decide as a society that, you know, opioids help a lot of patients, and so we want that to be available to some people, for example, and we can't turn around and then sue the people who made them.
All right. So this is a very satisfying and interesting conversation with the two of you. I do want to make time to get one more subject in before we go to our hubbubs, because while it might be 20 in the 20s outside, spring is coming, and we are just a week away from the start of spring training for the Red Sox, believe it or not. First spring training game is February 22nd. And you might have heard that they will take the field next Saturday without superstar outfielder Mookie Betts and pitcher David Price. Price and Betts were shipped to Los Angeles in a trade that was finalized on Monday, and here is a bit of what that sounded like.
Before we get to questions, we would like to formally introduce and welcome David Price and Mookie Betts.
To be able to jump onto a team like the Dodgers, you know, a team that has had the amount of success they have had the past couple of years.
I have a lot of memories in Boston. Obviously, I'd say the most fun is the World Series.
Yeah, this is a real tough one for a lot of people in the organization to move on from Mookie.
It was very clear to us that this move would come with a lot of fan backlash.
They're in big trouble in this division. The Yankees are that good, and the Rays are really good also. And in a very strong American League, I'm not sure how the Red Sox are going to make it to the playoffs.
All right, so just to be clear, you heard there from David Price, Mookie Betts, Red Sox general manager Brian O'Halloran, Red Sox chief of baseball operations Chaim Bloom, and ESPN baseball analyst Tim Kirchen. And I'll be honest, we're going to bring in one more voice because, frankly, I could not keep him out of the room on this
sports
one.
Sports rage! It's good to feel alive again.
There we go. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, who's going to join us for this final topic. Chris, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Marie and Jennifer, you were both saying that you had to call your sons on this one, but they felt strongly about it, did they not?
Not the gender stereotype, but the two women had to run and call their sons.
So what did they and you have to say? What do you think about this?
Well, my 14-year-old son is very upset about Mookie.
Smart kid.
Not so upset about David Price.
Yeah. Still a smart kid.
And he does understand, though, that this was a financial decision on the part of the Red Sox. The one thing he said to me was that they should have kept Mookie for one more year until he did become a free agent, and they still could have saved the money down the road. And he's kind of angry that they didn't hold on to him for at least that one more year.
Listeners, we've got time to take your calls on this, too. Call in, because I know you're thinking something about it. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris, your reaction to what Jennifer just said?
I think it's right on the money, but I want to back up one more step, because I think a lot of fans, the fans who have kind of been okay with this or are trying to rationalize this deal, are operating from the point of view that this ownership was never going to sign Mookie Betts, which is true, because they don't like to spend money. And I think that is the really frustrating part here, because you're talking about an owner in John Henry who's worth $2.7 billion, according to Forbes. And the most likely outcome of this scenario here, it's kind of complicated with the luxury tax. There's different thresholds. But the most likely scenario is he's going to save about $10 million.
Personally. So, Marie, I saw you nodding to Chris.
Yeah, that
there,
was
so
my son's reaction.
Jump on in
that
here.
That absolutely was my son's reaction. This was all about the money. He says they're ruining the franchise. That was his reaction to it.
I mean, it really comes down to me.
Short-sighted.
You own a team in a city. That team is part of the city, and it's... It should be different than just a straight business. I think it's part of the city's culture. It's part of life here. And I think you have a responsibility to the fans to put at least a decent, if not the best product on the field that you can.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. And I do want to get our geeks on a little bit about this question of the role of a team in a community, because that is a piece of the picture here. There will be a lot of people who will argue that basically, the Sox have given up on this year, traded Mookie Betts, traded David Price. The prospects that we got are just that, prospects. They're not people who are coming to play for us this year, really. And we didn't get somebody to supplement our pitching. And yet we charge very high prices. We have a park right down in the middle of downtown that occupies a lot of mind share. I mean, this is the Red Sox Nation. What is the proper relationship between the team and the community, Jennifer?
That's a good question. I mean, I do think at this point that the Boston Bruins have sort of become our number one team, right? That
interesting.
That's where all the energy and attention is going right now. Now, part of that is because they're in season. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, if you look at the ratings for the Red Sox last year, they weren't great. People are excited about the Red Sox. They're excited about the Celtics right now. And I think that's what people are talking about.
Let's grab a call. Anne is calling from Fenway. Anne, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a painter, and I actually paint outside at Fenway Park.
Wow.
And I think losing Mookie Betts, I think we need heroes. We need personalities that can galvanize us, especially when there's a slump and we're losing Alex Cora. So it's devastating. And kind of because I paint on site, not from photographs, I'm painting Fenway Park, and you can kind of feel the heartbeat of the park and the heartbeat of the fans. And this is sort of devastating. I know there might be financial considerations, but I don't know how we could do that.
Okay, so that's kind of a drop the mic piece of feedback right there. Yeah. From Anne. So she's also referring to a month ago, Alex Cora mutually agreed with management to leave the team after he was the bench coach for the Houston Astros, which were caught cheating in 2017, right, Chris? So what's your reaction to that, Marie, to what Anne was just saying?
I agree with her. I think those teams, and I want to say the Celts and it, they're all struggling now for various reasons. But I think the Sox are at the heart. I mean, if I think about particularly the young people around here, it's part of the very heart of the city. And they are struggling right now with some credibility issues. And you took one of the stars and you took part of the heart of that team and you ripped it away for what purpose? And it sounds like there wasn't much savings there and so it's just too bad that the fans were not at the center of the thought of this deal.
It's so frustrating too, because if you look at the history of the way this ownership runs this team, they've done this before. They had a homegrown guy in John Lester that you knew could be your pitcher, your ace going forward. They lowballed him with an insultingly low offer in the offseason. He ends up getting traded to Chicago. He wins a World Series there, and then he walks. You never get him back. And now we're seeing it play out again. A 27-year-old superstar, the second best player in the game, who came up through your system. If you're not going to pay this guy, who will you pay?
Okay, but I'm not sure I believe that we were ever going to make a deal with Mookie Betts. So we've had some debate about this here inside the studio. Here is senior news writer for Morning Edition, Sarah Rose Brenner, a big sports fan, on why she's okay with us trading Betts.
The owners were never going to give him the years and the money that he was going to get as a free agent. So I don't, honestly, it pains me to say this, but I don't think the Red Sox were going anywhere this year regardless. So why not trade him and get something? They don't have a farm system. They need prospects. So why not send Mookie Betts somewhere else? What was the point of keeping him for a year when you probably weren't going to make the playoffs anyway?
And if we were going to lose him in a year anyway, or if we weren't going to make the playoffs, what is wrong with the long play?
Well, you mentioned this before. It's two things. It's heroes, right? Having heroes for the people of this town and the fans of the team, and investing in quality, right? He was one of the top players in the league, and being willing to pay for the quality.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. You're not going to get a guy to fill this role for less money than you would have had to pay Mookie Betts, or not substantially less anyway. But I want to take issue also with this idea that the Red Sox were not going to contend this year regardless. Last year was a down year, for sure. But if you look back, 2018, we saw an historic run by this team ending in a World Series title. They still had 9 of the 10 best players from that title run on the roster, and that's not counting Rafael Devers, who's a young stud who's coming up and coming into his own, and Christian Vasquez, who was one of the top 5 catchers in the league last year. So this notion that just because last year was a down year, this team was not going to compete, I have a real problem with that.
All right, so we're going to let you go, Radio Boston's Chris Sidorick, on that note. Thanks very much.
Thanks for letting me vent.
Absolutely. Because Marie and Jennifer, this leaves us just enough time to end with our hubbubs, which are those brief stories or events that caught your attention this week. Jennifer, you are up. What is your hubbub?
So one story that caught my attention that I don't see getting a lot of national or even local press is a bill introduced by some lawmakers in New Hampshire that would prevent the state from revealing the outcome of the popular vote until the Electoral College has met and done its constitutional duty.
Interesting.
And that sounds sort of arcane, but the reason behind it, the goal behind it, is that there is this movement in the country. Certain states have passed what's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And those states who have agreed to that have agreed to give their electors to the person who wins the popular vote, irrespective of who wins the Electoral College. And New Hampshire is basically saying, we're not going to let you do that. We're not going to let you take power away from New Hampshire. So we're not going to tell you the outcome of our statewide popular vote in order to preserve the Electoral College. Now, that bill has just been introduced, and I don't know how far it will get, but I thought it was a very
interesting
tactic from a small state trying to preserve its power in presidential elections.
Very interesting. Marie St. Fleur, what do you got?
Well, you know what? I know I do watch Fox News every once in a while, and guess what?
What?
Virginia, who's the state for lovers. Who knew? They did not. You couldn't have sex if you're not married in Virginia.
It was illegal?
It was illegal. And this week, I believe, they passed. They removed that law, and now if you're an adult and you're not married and in Virginia, just in time for Valentine's Day.
February 2020, it becomes legal.
It's now legal.
To have sex outside of wedlock
in Virginia.
Well, I guess we should note that that does come just in time for Valentine's Day.
Yes.
And for the record, our team checked it out. It does still have to pass the Senate. All right. So listen, so my hubbub comes courtesy of the Globe and the MBTA today, because the T launched a social media campaign today called #NextStopTheWorld, in which they were inviting 60-second video love letters to your favorite T stop or route or station. And the winner was supposed to receive a ticket anywhere that JetBlue Airlines goes. Well, riders have been posting some tweets, but they aren't really love letters. Here are just a couple of samples. Fires, delays, and derailments. What's not to love? Was one that got posted. Another was, quote, my favorite T stop doesn't exist. It's clean, modern, well-maintained, and the buses, trains arrive in a timely fashion so we're not stuck in the sub-freezing temperatures for 20-plus minutes, end quote. Couple of videos, too, but those were of things like fires in the T stations as you're driving by in your T car. I don't think that this was exactly what the MBTA had in mind when they started the social media campaign this morning, but it definitely was, what's that meme that my kids say? Mood, I think, for MBTA riders this week. So there is my hubbub.
That's awesome. Yeah.
All right. Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks for joining us this week on Week in Review.
Thanks for having me.
And Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the chief executive officer of a cannabis company. Thanks
always
for being with us.
Always good to be here. Always good to be here.
All right. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.